For 7 centuries the ghost of old Crassus had haunted the East in vain. The imperial armies relied upon Christian Arab auxiliaries, and these deserted to the Muslims as the armies joined issue. A great parade of priests, sacred banners, pictures, and holy relics was made by the Byzantine host, and it was further sustained by the chanting of monks. But there was no magic in the relics, and little conviction about the chanting. On the Arab side of the emirs and sheikhs harangued the troops, and after the ancient Arab fashion, the shrill voices of women in the rear encouraged their men. The Muslim ranks were full of believers before whom shone victory or paradise. The battle was never in doubt after the defection of the irregular cavalry. An attempt to retreat dissolved into a rout and became a massacre. The Byzantine army had fought with its back to the river, which was presently choked with its dead. Thereafter, Heraclius slowly relinquished all Syria, which he had so lately won back from the Persians, to his new antagonists. Damascus soon fell, and a year later the Muslims entered Antioch. For a time they had to abandon it again to a last effort from Constantinople, but they re-entered it for good under Khalid. Meanwhile, on the Eastern Front, after a swift initial success which gave them Hira, the Persian resistance stiffened. The dynastic struggle had ended at last in the coming of a king of kings, and a general of ability had been found in Rustam. He gave battle at Kedesia in 637. His army was just such another composite host as Darius had led into Thrace or Alexander defeated at Issus. It was a medley of levies. He had 33 war elephants, and he sat on a golden throne upon a raised platform behind the Persian ranks, surveying the battle, which throne will remind the reader of Herodotus, the Hellespont and Salamis more than 1,000 years before. The battle lasted 3 days. Each day the Arabs attacked, and the Persian host held its ground until nightfall called a truce. On the 3rd day the Arabs received reinforcements, and towards the evening the Persians attempted to bring the struggle to an end by a charge of elephants. At first the huge beasts carried all before them. Then one was wounded painfully and became uncontrollable, rushing up and down between the armies. Its panic affected the others, and for a time both armies remained dumbfounded in the red light of sunset, watching the frantic efforts of these grey, squealing monsters to escape from the tormenting masses of armed men that hemmed them in. It was by the merest chance that at last they broke through the Persian and not through the Arab array, and that it was the Arabs who were able to charge home upon the resulting confusion. The twilight darkened to night, but this time the armies did not separate. All through the night the Arabs smote in the name of Allah, and pressed upon the shattered and retreating Persians. Dawn broke upon the vestiges of Rustam's army in flight far beyond the litter of the battlefield. Its path was marked by scattered weapons and war material, abandoned transport, and the dead and dying. The platform and the golden throne were broken down, and Rustam lay dead among a heap of dead men. Already in 634, Abu Bekr had died and given place to Omar, the prophet's brother-in-law, as caliph, and it was under Omar, 634 to 643, that the main conquests of the Muslims occurred. The Byzantine Empire was pushed out of Syria altogether, but at the Taurus Mountains the Muslim thrust was held. Armenia was overrun, all Mesopotamia was conquered, and Persia beyond the rivers. Egypt passed almost passively from Greek to Arab. In a few years the Semitic race, in the name of God and his prophet, had recovered nearly all the dominions it had lost to the Aryan Persians 1,000 years before. Jerusalem fell early, making a treaty without standing siege, and so the true cross, which had been carried off by the Persians a dozen years before and elaborately restored by Heraclius, passed once more out of the rule of Christians. But it was still in Christian hands. The Christians were to be tolerated, paying only a poll tax, and all the churches and all the relics were left in their possession. Jerusalem made a peculiar condition for its surrender. The city would give itself only to the Caliph Omar in person. Hitherto he'd been in Medina organizing armies and controlling the general campaign. He came to Jerusalem in 638, and the manner of his coming shows how swiftly the vigor and simplicity of the first Muslim onset was being sapped by success. He came the 600-mile journey with only one attendant. He was mounted on a camel, and a bag of barley, another of dates, a water skin, and a wooden platter were his provision for the journey. He was met outside the city by his chief captains, robed splendidly in silks and with richly caparisoned horses. At this amazing sight, the old man was overcome with rage. He slipped down from his saddle, scrabbled up dirt and stones with his hands, and pelted these fine gentlemen, shouting abuse. What was this insult? What did this finery mean? Where were his warriors? Where were the desert men? He wouldn't let these popinjays escort him. He went on with his attendant, and the smart emirs rode afar off, well out of range of his stones. He met the Patriarch of Jerusalem, who had apparently taken over the city from its Byzantine rulers, alone. With the Patriarch he got on very well. They went round the holy places together, and Omar, now a little appeased, made sly jokes at the expense of his two magnificent followers. Equally indicative of the tendencies of the time is Omar's letter, ordering one of his governors who had built himself a palace at Kufa to demolish it again. "They tell me," he wrote, "you would imitate the palace of Khosroes, and that you would even use the gates that once were his. Will you also have guards and porters at those gates, as Khosroes had? Will you keep the faithful afar off and deny audience to the poor? Would you depart from the custom of our prophet and be as magnificent as those Persian emperors, and ascend to hell even as they have done?" Sixth, Abu Bakr and Omar the First are the two master figures in the history of Islam. It isn't within our scope here to describe the wars by which in 125 years Islam spread itself from the Indus to the Atlantic and Spain, and from Kashgar on the borders of China to Upper Egypt. Two maps must suffice to show the limits to which the vigorous impulse of the new faith carried the Arab idea and the Arabic scriptures before worldliness, the old trading and plundering spirit, and the glamour of the silk robe had completely recovered their paralyzing sway over the Arab intelligence and will. The reader will note how the great tide swept over the footsteps of Yuan Chuang, and how easily in Africa the easy conquests of the Vandals were repeated in the reverse direction. And if the reader entertains any delusions about a fine civilization, either Persian, Roman, Hellenic, or Egyptian, being submerged by this flood, the sooner he dismisses such ideas, the better. Islam prevailed because it was the best social and political order the times could offer. It prevailed because everywhere it found politically apathetic peoples, robbed, oppressed, bullied, uneducated and unorganized, and it found selfish and unsound governments out of touch with any people at all. It was the broadest, freshest and cleanest political idea that had yet come into actual activity in the world, and it offered better terms than any other to the mass of mankind. The capitalistic and slave-holding system of the Roman Empire and the literature and culture and social tradition of Europe had altogether decayed and broken down before Islam arose. It was only when mankind lost faith in the sincerity of its representatives that Islam, too, began to decay. the larger part of its energy spent itself in conquering and assimilating Persia and Turkestan. Its most vigorous thrusts were northwardly from Persia and westwardly through Egypt.